Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. It's the Rose Colombo, right here for you at Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday. And today is October 6th, 2021. And it is noon. So grab a cup of coffee, grab a snack, grab some lunch. Sit back and relax because we have a dynamic show for you today. Like always, authors and experts. On part one of our show, part two, we will be discussing Silicon Valley, China, and Taiwan. You won't want to miss that either. But first of all, we'll be entering into the world of authors and experts. And boy, do we have a great author and expert just for you today. His name is Dr. Henry M. Silbert, and he will be our very special guest on the show today. And he has an incredible story, and he is going to talk to us about the book that is hot off the press, An Indelible Event and Detour Through a Global Childhood. And we're going to go back to his miraculous recovery from a fatal car crash. And he's going to tell us exactly what happened to him. And it's going to be so intriguing because it's going to empower you, it's going to enlighten you, and it's going to entertain you as well, because we all like to be entertained, right? So on that note, I'm going to take a little break, and we're going to go into the city of Benson, Arizona, where you will find the best homemade desserts and cooking you ever tasted. So we'll be back right after this important message.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
That's right. Be sure to bring your appetite to the Horseshoe Cafe. And that is right at a crossroads between Tucson and Sierra Vista, Phoenix. So anywhere you're traveling in that area, you will want to stop by at the Horseshoe Cafe. And, you know, there's so many things going on in this country today that it does make you wonder, you know, what are we going to do about all these issues? So sometimes we need to get away from the negative and go into the positive. And so that's exactly what we're going to do when we enter into the world of authors and experts. So don't touch that dial. We'll be back in just a moment.
listening is an art that humans are losing to the world of robots. Robots don't have any tone or human feelings. The addiction to communicate by texting isn't going away. People are feeling isolated, lonely, frustrated. People need people willing to listen to them. Can you imagine getting a text message that read, "You're fired," or "Hi, would you marry me?" It is happening. Columbo Chronicles is the option and the answer to human communication. Columbo Chronicles provides email access to your ideas and issues. Take advantage of this opportunity now. Go to columbochronicles.com. Click on subscribe today. Columbo is spelled C-O-L-O-M-B-O Chronicles. Fill out the form, submit it, bookmark and subscribe today. Remember the name, columbochronicles.com.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. We're back on Columbo Chronicles Live, and we're about to enter into the great world of authors and experts. And we have a dynamic author and expert for you today. Henry M. Silver, Ph.D. He was born in Philadelphia in 1948. He did his undergraduate work between 1967 and 1971. He has a doctoral studies at New York University between 1976 and 85. And he read for a Bachelor of Philosophy degree in Latin American Area Studies at the University of Oxford. He spent his childhood years living and attending elementary schools in New Orleans, Guatemala, Mexico, Santiago, and Buenos Aires. He spent his high school years at Hanover High School in Hanover, New Hampshire. As a survey associate and statistician, Dr. Henry M. Silver worked at the conference board for 23 years until his retirement and co-authored several reports regarding business matters. Previously, he worked on projects ranging from childhood hunger to drug use and the HIV/AIDS epidemics, all very important issues even today. As a visiting professor at the Colegio de Mexico, Dr. Silver taught comparative politics of Latin America, and as an adjunct professor teaching various sociology classes in New York City. So let's welcome Dr. Henry M. Silver to our wonderful show today, Columbo Chronicles Live. Hi, Dr. Silver. How are you today?
Good morning, good afternoon, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to be with you, too. Would you like me to call you Henry?
Yes, please.
All righty. So, Henry, read your wonderful story and your miraculous healing. But first of all, I was wondering, since it is a memoir and the title is rather long, Indelible Event and Detour Through a Global Childhood, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your childhood and your family life, and what type of a child and personality did you have prior to your tragedy?
Well, the length of the title has something to do with the length of life and the detours that we take because of the things we do. The Indelible Act was, the Indelible Event was an accident that I had in Mexico when I was not 7 years old yet. And what happened was that I we crashed into a car, and I rode down the mountain in our car, and I spent 6 months in the hospital and 6 months in Mexico City, rehabilitating myself. And then I went back to school in New Orleans. Title also suggests that the things we do to ameliorate these challenges and to deal with the challenges that we have and the challenges ahead cause us to take detours. And the detour that I took was a global childhood through Latin America with my parents.
Well, even as a child, though, you were, it said you were ornery and precocious and somewhat of a nerdy kid who liked playing the violin and playing bridge. So were you also an introvert? And so how did your tragedy bring you out of that?
Well, what happened was that my parents were very, very stubborn. They wouldn't take no for an answer. And the doctor that took care of me in Mexico, his name was Dr. Sanchez Garibay, he was just as stubborn as my parents. And said, let him do what he can. And he can do whatever he can, whatever will come. So while I played violin as a kid before the operation, I also took violin lessons after the accident. And while I didn't play as well, I didn't play in tune. I didn't know how to count. But I was working on it, and it helped my body sync in tune and get a flow to it. Because, you see, I couldn't walk after the accident. And so I had to learn how to walk and read, write, and talk. So my body was adjusting through these processes that my parents were just as surprised as I was that I did. I am an avid bridge player. I used to play bridge before the accident. I played bridge after the accident, and I still do. And I love it. And so those things, the mental things, helped me out a lot.
So it's sort of like mind over matter and having a strong will as a child to overcome the tragedy. Did you believe in a higher power as well?
Well, I think so. You know, at the end of the book, I mentioned the fact that maybe I'm such an optimist, a hopeful person, because of the way that people in the town of Ciudad Juarez, where the accident occurred, came out of their houses and came down to the ravine to get me and save my life. Maybe, spiritually or something like that, maybe I remember this. Maybe that's what made me the optimist that I am.
Well, that's fantastic. And so why did your doctor say, after you experienced these life-threatening injuries and after he did his initial exam, this boy doesn't want to die?
Because for all purposes, I should not have been alive because of the injuries. And at the small town that I was in, they could not help me. But the doctor, and it's circuitous, but very briefly, my father got on the phone with my mother in New Orleans, who was still in New Orleans. The operator, the long-distance operator, was listening and said, maybe we can patch you into the University of Chicago, because they were doing something with neurosurgeons in Mexico, and they patched us into then the doctor in Mexico, who was very reluctant to go up and see me. But when he saw me, he said, no, this guy should be dead, but he doesn't know how to die. And so he took me as a patient, as a relative of his, and put me into the military hospital where he was a surgeon. So that's the long and the short of it. And I wasn't unconscious, but I did come through.
Yes, but these were unconventional experiences that your parents planned for your further progress. And so, you know, as you were moving from country to country, city to city in Latin America, and then back to the United States, did that define your global awakening? And what were the cornerstones that you recall in this process that you believed stuck in your mind and kept you going?
Well, I was in Argentina for, I don't know, the second time, and I was sitting in my window behind the blind, and there were some kids looking at the car that my father had brought down from New Orleans to Argentina, and the bike that was in the back, and they were marveling at the dashboard, and you know this was all in Spanish, and so one of the kids saw me behind the blind and came over to me, and said, in Spanish, "De donde tu vienes? Where do you come from?" I said, I pointed to the north, pointed upward, and they said, he said, "But you can't come from the sky. You're not dead." I said, "No, I come from the north." "Oh, you come from Mendoza?" "No, I come from America." "But we are Americans. This is the Argentina of America." And said, "No, I come from New York." "Oh, you're from New York. Welcome, my friend." And we had a very nice friendship from then on. But that was my global awakening. I realized that no country is the center of the universe for everybody. And that every country has something to add. The people of every country have something to add to the totality of life.
That's so true, and we don't really think about that. So, I know that you were interested in helping diminish discrimination and prejudice in the country and the world, and to make the world a better place. So what would be something that you would suggest that people do to diminish discrimination and racism and prejudice in the world? Because you all are a globalist child. We're a globalist child.
Well, I think increasing the well-being of public schools is the first step in the process. Because public schools are schools that enable people from different walks of life learn to live with each other, learn to play with each other, learn to work with each other, and learn to understand that each other's viewpoints are valid in certain ways. And I grew up, well, whenever I went to school in the United States, it was public schools. In New Orleans, my father and mother had to leave because of the stench of racism in 1956 and 58. And that they were planning to close the public schools. In Hanover, New Hampshire, I found a different type of racism. Racism against Judaism. And I dealt with that myself, but that was very new because I had never been experienced racism against Jews before. But maybe because I was too young. I came out of it with a new understanding, with a understanding that it was my duty to look out for the dispossessed, the underdog, the disadvantaged, the unequal, and work for a better society so that we could live together and work together and prosper together.
Yes, because when you think about the world, it is a very small place now because of all the transportation and the technology we have. And so I think your work is very, very important, and what you're saying is very important to continuing to bring peace into the world. And I believe that you believe in communication as being an important tool. Is that correct?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so what would you say that people can do, not only to help reduce discrimination, but if they did that, would that help reduce poverty as well?
Well, it's a bundle. I think that reducing inequality, reducing poverty, reducing discrimination, one way to do it is for people to get together in groups and talk over their differences and understand their differences, where they're coming from, what their primary goals are, et cetera, like that. And more important is that people should also get more education. You know, it's not enough just to have high school education. One of the studies we did in the conference board was that we wanted to know what employers thought of their high school, two-year college, and four-year college hires. And we found out that the two-year college, that the high school graduates needed very big remedial work on history, on mathematics, on communications, on leadership development. The people at the two-year college needed more work on IT development, but they were almost there. The good part of it is that the people at the four-year college were able to communicate on a higher level. So I think more and more and more people should get educated and should be able to go to college, finish high school and go to college, because that provides you with a space, the freedom space to think and to learn new things before you're tied down with family strictures and structures.
Going back to your book, Henry, An Indelible Event and Detour Through a Global Childhood by Henry M., that's like Mark, Henry M. Silvert, and Dr. Henry M. Silvert, by the way. Going back to your childhood and the accident, were you in a coma when they found you? Were you blacked out? And did you notice anything different that happened to you at that moment when you woke up?
Yes. Thank you for asking. I was in a coma for 2.5 weeks. Well, for 2.5 months. In and out. They took me and put me into the bathtub with ice three times a day to get the fever down. But But one of the interesting things was I saw my mother in the hospital, and I knew that my mother had stayed somewhere else, wasn't traveling with us. So I wondered how she got in to my hotel room, because I still thought I was in a hotel room. So I thought, well, maybe she put herself into a Winston cigarette carton and flew through the air to my hotel room. And that's how she got there. Or some other times it was maybe she put herself into Winston cigarette matchbox. I didn't know why my bed had bars on it, because, of course, my daddy knew I was old enough to sleep by myself. And where was my daddy? Didn't he sleep with me when we were in a hotel? All these questions, I couldn't ask him because I had no speech. And people were rushing back and forth and doing all kinds of things to me, taking temperature, whatever they were doing. I don't know what they were doing. But they were doing these things, and they were telling me to do things. I didn't understand what, but I did them anyway because of the emotions. But this was mind-boggling. But the doctor was very adamant. He said, let him do what he can do. When he walks, let him fall down. If he falls down, mm-hmm. let him get up and walk again. And I did this for 6 months in the hospital. Then for another 6 months, I went to physical therapy. And the doctor took me to the hospital with a physical therapist three times a week in the morning. But he would come and pick me up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he would go through the poorest sections of town curing people and taking bullets out of people's arms, delivering babies. And for this he would take a tortilla or a thank you. But it wasn't important. The money wasn't important to him. And I was fascinated with this. When we got to the hospital, I went to my physical therapy. And then after physical therapy, I ran up to the fourth floor, his floor, and I changed into scrubs, and I went into the operating room to stand next to him while he was operating. So this was a unique doctor. And I admire him because he gave me all the hope that I had lost in the accident back, along with my parents, too. Now, one of my uncles, I should say he's crazy, but he's not. He was a very important psychiatrist. He wrote a book on schizophrenia in Baltimore. But he said to my mother, you're going to have to put him on a regimen of 3 courses of spinach a day and put him on a very big regimen of steak. My mother said, you know, my mother wasn't too nice when she spoke, but she told him where to go. We never follow his instructions. And in fact, I don't like spinach because of this. Anyway, that was
well. A lot of kids don't like spinach.
Well, I'm not a kid anymore.
So I wanted to ask you, how difficult was it for you to get the strength up to actually get out of bed, stand up, and try to walk?
Okay. I don't know how to say no. So when they told me to do this, I did it. It was difficult because of they had to show me how to stand up straight, how to catch my balance, things like that. But little by little, I did it. It wasn't difficult because I didn't think of it as difficult. I thought of it as a learning experience because I didn't know what difficult meant. I really didn't. My vocabulary was very limited. I never said no because whenever I did, people say, you do it anyway. So why should I say no? They're just going to contradict me. Yeah. So,
and what about your speech? I mean, did you have to go to speech therapy?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. When I went back to elementary school in New Orleans, I went to LaSalle Elementary School in New Orleans. They put me in speech class for a few hours a week. Why? Because I couldn't pronounce the S's with a S instead of S and instead of a lisp. Because in Argentina and because in Latin America, they don't care. It doesn't matter if you use a lisp or a sit. So I had problems with that. But on the other hand, I had a wonderful third grade teacher who got furious with the class for not reading their homework assignments. I couldn't read it anyway, but my parents read it to me, but I'm not going to tell. So the students said they read it to me. She got furious because no one had read the science homework, and it was in September. And she said, you will get an A, an E for excellent on the rest of your report card if you answer this question correctly. Why do butterflies change colors? And I had and she went on in alphabetical order, and I had a crush on a girl whose last name started with B. And I said, she knows. And she said, no, take a chance. Answer it. And I answered it correctly. Because I remember what my mother told me, which in a sense, told me and everybody else that I had a good memory.
Mm. That's amazing. So you got an excellent there. And you went on went on with your education even after all your experiences, and you got your PhD, and you did travel and you did learn so much, and you shared information after this miraculous healing, but it did take hard work. It didn't happen overnight, but do you consider this a miracle?
In a sense, it is a miracle. In a sense, it's not. I say it in the sense, and the reason I say it's not is that many people can do what I did with persistence, with stubbornness, with assistance from others. Some people can't. But I don't think it's a miracle in the sense that I had all the everything was there for me. I just had to appropriate it and learn how to use it again. And I still have problems with, for example, remembering dates. And I'm a good, you can ask my wife. I am a stickler for dates. But I had to learn how to do the dates. I can't learn dates by saying, oh, Yeah, what happened in 1715? No, I have to understand what was occurring in 1715 to understand what was the importance of 1715. Now, you might not know, but it was the year that Waterloo lost the battle of, that Napoleon lost the battle of Waterloo. But that was also the end of the standing armies, where armies would stand across from each other and kill each other. Beginning, and it was the beginning of a different kind of warfare. Anyway, that's just a little reminiscence of how I go about learning things.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that because, you know, connecting dates to events. I mean, you remembered today's date. We had a date.
Yes, we had a date. And I made it.
I'm so happy we did connect. And I love your story. And I hope everyone reads your story because I truly believe it's a miraculous story. And because not only miraculous, but the strong will to live and to embrace life and then not end there, to continue on to share your story, to give other people empowerment, enlightenment, and hope that no matter what happens to you in this life, you can overcome. And so lastly, Dr. Henry M. Silbert, author of An Incredible Event and Detour Through a Global Childhood, the last question I have for you is that I read that this experience created a full life that transcended your initial tragedy. Why did you make that comment, and what do you mean by it?
Well, the initial tragedy always stuck in my mind, but there were times that I forgot about it and was able to go beyond what even I thought I could do. For example, I'm working for the conference board for 23 years, an amazing feat. Teaching adjunct to college students and trying to get them to read and write rather than take tests was a feat that I enjoyed tremendously. And this transcended everything that went on before. I used my Oxford education as a vehicle to teach people in the United States college system how to understand, how to comprehend social events. And that's my life goal.
Well, that's a wonderful goal because understanding and communication is everything to helping people open and expand their minds into no matter what happens to you in this life, the more knowledge you have, the better off you are. That also includes life's experiences such as yours. So now's your time to shine, Henry M. Silbert, and tell our audience any message you would like, and also tell us if you have any contact information online on where we can buy An Indelible Event and Detour Through a Global Childhood.
Yes, ma'am. Well, one of the things I think is important is that you got to keep the faith. And the second thing is, if you would like to purchase a book, you can purchase it online at any bookseller, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Scribd's. I also have a website, henrymsilbert.com, where you can find out information about the book. You can't buy it there, but you can find out information about the book. And I'm just overwhelmed with the great interview you did.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm honored to have you on our show, Dr. Henry M. Solvert, and hear your miraculous story, because I truly believe in a higher power, but I also believe in a strong mind, which I see you have, and I believe in knowledge and educating other people and sharing our stories with them to give them hope, which you have done and accomplished. And I hope you will keep up your good work. And I want to say God bless you, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future. Thank you so much.
God bless you, and maybe you have me on again.
I will love to have you on again.
Thank you very
Bye-bye.
Much. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. And Dr. Henry M. Solvert, or Henry M. Solvert author, wrote the book, An Indelible Event and Deter to a Global Childhood. You can look him up online. He has a website. You can buy his book on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and Scribd. And you will be enlightened, empowered, and no matter what's going on in your life, you will be able to face a tragedy. Hopefully it doesn't happen to you, but if you do come across any type of tragedy, you will be blessed by reading this wonderful book. And Dr. Solvert's last name is spelled S like Sam, I-L-V like Victor, E-R-T, and he has left the building. And I am going to take a break, and I will be back with the world of politics. So don't touch that child, because don't touch that dial, not that child, that dial, because we're going to talk about Silicon Valley and China and Taiwan.
Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
That's right. Be sure to bring your appetite to the Horseshoe Cafe.
Columbo is on their trail.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot...
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. We had a lot of Columbo Chronicles right there coming on, but got it taken care of. So now we're going to enter into the world of politics. And I think this is a really important article, and every American should be aware of it, because it depends on our economy, our military, our health care, our communications. Just about everything is tied across the oceans, leaving America and Americans very vulnerable to an economic collapse or an invasion, or becoming impoverished, in my opinion. This is on Time Magazine, and it's entitled Silicon Ally. Inside the Taiwan firm that makes the world's tech run. And it's by Charlie Campbell, C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L. He wrote an excellent article, and it says, on the northwest coast of Taiwan, nestled between mudflats teeming with fiddler crabs and sweet-scented persimmon orchards, sits the world's most important company. The world's most important company that you probably never heard of. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, or TSMC. This is the world's largest contract manufacturer of the semiconductor chips, otherwise known as integrated circuits or just chips, that power our phones, laptops, cars, watches, refrigerators, and more. Its clients include Apple, Intel, Qualcomm, AMD, and NVIDIA. Now, I want you to think about that for a moment. It's not the superpower, America, that's supplying the world with microchips. It's Taiwan and Communist China. So I really want you to think about how serious this is when President Bill Clinton and the Democrats and the globalists decided that they would open our Long Beach Naval Base and the Long Beach port and give it away to the former Chinese leader in 1993 who had committed a genocide against his own people. And Anthony J. Hilder, a guest of mine on my former cable television show, Women Fight Back and Issues of the Day, to Women Fight Back morphed into Issues of the Day, that discussed injustices and legal abuses and world events. As a guest on my cable television show, Issues of the Day, Anthony J. Hilder stated that he led the protest against President Bill Clinton handing over and giving away American property on international, on our international waters, inside our international waters, the Long Beach Naval Base and the Long Beach Port, free access. And at one point, I believe it was in 1993, they were caught smuggling in the AK-47s that the Democrats have been shouting about for decades, that they want to remove from anyone who owns one in the USA. So how many were smuggled into the USA from Communist China? So at that point, I read that Communist China had threatened to blow Los Angeles off the face of the map. And of course, we read about the stories that were reported back then of the allegations that Bill Clinton had allowed Communist China to tear the national security, tear the White House, have state dinners in the White House, rent out the Lincoln bedroom, and that there were allegations of bribes being made for this unethical and dangerous agendas to our country and to the American people and our sovereignty. And under the Clinton administration, it was Bill Clinton who got involved with the globalists and the oil industry and the Wall Street billionaires and millionaires and decided that he would go along with President Bush's North American Union, enacted by the CFR, to make America a borderless nation and open our borders and flood our nation with third world, uneducated, poor people who were unidentified, non-vetted from around the world. Now, why would they do this? Why would they do this unless they were seeking to take down the United States of America as the superpower in the world, make China the superpower in the world, and create a globalist world controlled by the billionaires and the millionaires while they eliminate the middle class, free enterprise, capitalism, God, Constitution, U.S. National Anthem, U.S. Pledge of Allegiance, and In God We Trust, One Nation Under God, and so forth, eliminated from our country, which has been slowly in the process being enacted in through the financial incentives offered through public schools and colleges and through universities as well. So we have to be really, really alert and vigilant how dangerous this devaluing of the American dollar and outsourcing under the Clinton administration manufacturing jobs and to foreign, third world foreign nations such as China, Taiwan, and other foreign nations so that they could use slave labor and make higher profits. In the meantime, developing robots and transhumans to reduce the population in America of heterosexuals, traditional marriage, procreation, and reduce the population so that they can, because the jobs have become obsolete, the manufacturing jobs, because they've reduced the number of manufacturing companies that were once making products that were made in the USA of high quality with quality inspections, which are not done now because we use most products imported from China and inspected by China that has heavy lead in many of their products, such as rice, and heavy pollution in their country. And we are buying masks made in China who seek to dominate America because they need more land. They need more clean water, clean air, because they're overpopulated and they have poor infrastructure. So this is a serious problem for America. Inside its boxy off-white headquarters in sleepy Henshaw County, technicians in brightly hued protective suits, white and blue for employees, green for contractors, and pink for pregnant women, push polished metal cards under a cello protective light. Above their heads, claw machines, nicknamed after the classic arcade game, haul 9 kg plastic containers containing 25 individual slices of wafers of silicone on rails among hundreds of manufacturing stations where they are extracted one by one for processing, much like a jukebox selecting a record. Only after 6 to 8 weeks of painstaking etching and testing can each wafer be carved up into individual chips to be dispatched around the planet. We always say that it's like building a high-rise. One TSMC made in Taiwan, one section manager tells Time, pointing to how his technicians diligently follow instructions dictated to them via tablet. You can only build one story at a time. The $550 billion $550 billion firm today, controls more than half, 50% of the global market for made-to-order chips and has an even tighter stranglehold on the most advanced processors with more than 90% of the market share by some estimates. So they own the market. TSMC is just absolutely critical, says Peter Hamberry, a semiconductor specialist at the Bain & Company consulting firm. They basically control the most complicated part of the semiconductor ecosystem, and they're a near monopoly at the bleeding edge. The importance of semiconductor chips has grown exponentially over the past half century. In 1969, the Apollo lunar module sent tens of thousands of transistors with a combined weight of 70 pounds to the moon. Today, an Apple MacBook crams 16 billion transistors within its total weight of just 3 pounds. The prevalence of chips will keep rising alongside the spread of mobile devices, the Internet of Things, 5G, 6G networks, and a growth in demand for computing power. Global chip sales were over $440 billion in 2020 and are projected to grow over 5% annually. President Joe Biden calls them critical products whose supply chain disruptions can put American lives and livelihood at risk, while the governments of Japan and South Korea compare the importance of semiconductors to rice. TSMC's success is cornering this vital market has become a geostrategic migraine. Pentagon is pressing the Biden administration to invest more in advanced chip making so its missiles and fighter jets are not dependent on a self-ruling island that China's strongman, President Xi Jinping, believes is a breakaway province and has repeatedly threatened to invade. More immediately, a global chip shortage has impacted a staggering 169 industries, according to Goldman Sachs analysis, from steel and ready-made concrete to air conditioning units and breweries, most drastically automakers across America, Japan, and Europe were forced to slow and even halt production, meaning 3.9 million fewer cars will roll out into the world showrooms this year than last. Car companies immediately pointed the finger at Taiwan's TSMC for the shortage. TSMC Chairman Mark Liu tells Time in an exclusive interview, "But I told them, you are my customers, customers, customers. How could I prioritize others and not give you the chips?" Well, just think about the blackmail and the threats that can happen to America because Bill Clinton on the Democrat Party and the RINOs sold out our manufacturing, outsourced our U.S. quality made products, which I was very concerned of back then and we reported on the radio, but came across a lot of negativity stating this was a horrible idea to open our borders and to allow just anybody to come on in, including spies from foreign nations, not just traffickers, not just drug dealers and organ harvesters and child traffickers and female traffickers and gun traffickers who then invade our poor cities where there's indigency, and recruit the young kids living in these poor neighborhoods into gangs to do their bidding on either use drugs and sell drugs, and they take the fall, and they either end up dead or end up in prison, but the drug lords do not, because the drug lords are busy supplying bribes to whoever is involved in this organized worldwide criminal syndicate, destroy the minds and the bodies of human beings. And also it reduces the population especially the fentanyl coming from China, which is the majority of the fentanyl coming through our open borders and our ports that Bill Clinton tried to give away, but Anthony J. Hilder was protested, had hearings at the Senate level, and the senators then allowed Bill Clinton to lease the Long Beach Navy base and the port of Long Beach to communist China, where we're outsourcing our food, our manufacturing companies, and well, communist China is eyeing Taiwan because Taiwan holds the keys with these chips to just about everything we utilize today that is manufactured in other countries and imported into America to be sold to the American people who actually developed these products and invented them. And yet we were sold out by the globalists involved in Wall Street, involved in government. And again, as George Putnam used to say when I was on KIEV 870 AM radio, follow the money. We are now vulnerable, especially if China takes over Taiwan somehow. We are vulnerable Americans to this new technology on the outsourcing of American jobs and microchips that should be made in the USA, so we are not vulnerable to being taken down economically, militarily, health-wise, and through artificial intelligence and the microchips needed for the military to fight back against an attack on America and Americans. So I hope that helped anyone who is interested in how America is losing its status in the world when we don't have Wall Street CEOs taking control of their own products and having them manufactured in the United States of America while living in the United States of America as American citizens, which I call fake Americans. So God bless you. God bless America. Remember, injustices can happen to you and they can happen to me. But together, we can make a positive difference. Remember, you are never alone when you tune into Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday, noon to 1 p.m. Or you can come back to blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles and scroll on down and listen to your favorite author and your favorite topic. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.